How to Contribute to Kernel Documentation by Jonathan Corbett. January 23, 2020. Some years back, I was caught in a weak moment and somehow became the kernel documentation maintainer. More recently, I've given a few talks on the state of kernel documentation and the sort of work that needs to be done to make things better. A key part of getting that work done is communicating to potential contributors the tasks that they might helpfully take on, a list that was, naturally, entirely undocumented. To that end, a version of the following document is currently under review and headed for the mainline. Read on to see how you, too, can help to make the kernel's documentation better. How to help improve kernel documentation. Documentation is an important part of any software development project. Good documentation helps to bring new developers in and helps established developers work more effectively. Without top-quality documentation, a lot of time is wasted in reverse engineering the code and making avoidable mistakes. With good documentation, instead, the result can be a project that is more effective and more inclusive. Unfortunately, the kernel's documentation currently falls far short of what it needs to be to support a project of this size and importance. This guide is for contributors who would like to improve that situation. Kernel documentation improvements can be made by developers at a variety of skill levels. They are a relatively easy way to learn the kernel process in general and find a place in the community. There is an endless list of tasks that need to be carried out to get our documentation to where it should be. This list contains a number of important items, but is far from exhaustive. If you see a different way to improve the documentation, please do not hold back. Addressing warnings. The documentation build currently spews out an unbelievable number of warnings. When you have that many warnings, you might as well have none at all. People ignore them, and they will never notice when their work adds new ones. For this reason, eliminating warnings is one of the highest priority tasks on the documentation to-do list. The task itself is reasonably straightforward, but it must be approached in the right way to be successful. Warnings issued by a compiler for C code can often be dismissed as false positives, leading to patches aimed at simply shutting the compiler up. Warnings from the documentation build almost always point at a real problem. Making those warnings go away requires understanding the problem and fixing it at its source. For this reason, patches fixing documentation warnings should probably not say fix a warning in the changelog title, they should indicate the real problem that has been fixed. Another important point is that documentation warnings are often created by problems in kernel.comments and C code. While the documentation maintainer appreciates being copied on fixes for these warnings, the documentation tree is often not the right one to actually carry those fixes. They should go to the maintainer of the subsystem in question. For example, I grabbed a pair of warnings nearly at random from a 5.5RC7 documentation build. The lines were split for readability. A quick look at the source file named above turned up a couple of kernel.comments that look like this. The problem is the missing, which confuses the build system's simplistic idea of what C comment blocks look like. This problem had been present since that comment was added in 2016, a full 4 years. Fixing it was a matter of adding the missing asterisks. A quick look at the history for that file showed what the normal format for subject lines in the target subsystem is, and script/get_maintainer.pl told me who should receive a patch. The resulting patch looked like this. The entire process only took a few minutes, and the fix was mailed off with pride. Of course, I then found that somebody else had fixed this problem in a separate tree, highlighting another lesson: always check Linux next to see if a problem has been fixed before you dig into it. Other fixes will take longer, especially those relating to structure members or function parameters that lack documentation. In such cases, it is necessary to work out what the role of those members or parameters is and describe them correctly. Overall, this task gets a little tedious at times, but it's highly important. If we can actually eliminate warnings from the documentation build, then we can start expecting developers to avoid adding new ones. Languishing kernel.comments. Developers are encouraged to write kernel.comments for their code, but many of those comments are never pulled into the docs build. That makes this information harder to find and, for example, makes Sphinx unable to generate links to that documentation. Adding kernel doc directives to the documentation to bring those comments in can help the community derive the full value of the work that has gone into creating them. The script/find_unused_docs.sh tool can be used to find these overlooked comments. Note that the most value comes from pulling in the documentation for exported functions and data structures. Many subsystems also have kernel.comments for internal use. Those should not be pulled into the documentation build unless they are placed in a document that is specifically aimed at developers working within the relevant subsystem. Typo fixes. Fixing typographical or formatting errors in the documentation is a quick way to figure out how to create and send patches, and it is a useful service. I am always willing to accept such patches. That said, once you have fixed a few, please consider moving on to more advanced tasks, leaving some typos for the next beginner to address. Please note that some things are not typos and should not be fixed. Both American and British English spellings are allowed within the kernel documentation. There is no need to fix one by replacing it with the other. The question of whether a period should be followed by one or two spaces is not to be debated in the context of kernel documentation. Other areas of rational disagreement, such as the Oxford comma, are also off topic here. As with any patch to any project, please consider whether your change is really making things better. Ancient documentation. Some kernel documentation is current, maintained, and useful. Some documentation is not. Dusty, old, and inaccurate documentation can mislead readers and casts doubt on our documentation as a whole. Anything that can be done to address such problems is more than welcome. Whenever you are working with a document, please consider whether it is current, whether it needs updating, or whether it should perhaps be removed altogether. Little value comes from fixing typos in a document full of obsolete information. There are a number of warning signs that you can pay attention to here. References to 2.x kernels. Pointers to SourceForge repositories or mailing lists. Nothing but typo fixes in the history for several years. Discussion of pre-Git workflows. Internal change logs ending in 1997. The best thing to do, of course, would be to bring the documentation current, adding whatever information is needed. Such work usually requires the cooperation of developers familiar with the subsystem in question. Developers are often more than willing to cooperate with people working to improve the documentation when asked nicely, and when their answers are listened to and acted upon. Some documentation is beyond hope. We occasionally find documents that refer to code that was removed from the kernel long ago. For example, there is surprising resistance to removing obsolete documentation, but we should do that anyway. Extra cruft in our documentation helps nobody. In cases where there is perhaps some useful information in a badly outdated document, and you are unable to update it, the best thing to do may be to add a warning at the beginning. The following text is recommended. That way, at least our long-suffering readers have been warned that the document may lead them astray. Documentation coherency. The old-timers around here will remember the Linux books that showed up on the shelves in the 1990s. They were simply collections of various documentation files scrounged from numerous locations across the net. The books have, mostly, improved since then, but the kernel's documentation is still mostly built on that model. It is thousands of files, almost each of which was written in isolation from all of the others. We don't have a coherent body of kernel documentation, we have thousands of individual documents. We have been trying to improve the situation through the creation of a set of books that group documentation for specific readers. These include the User Space API Guide, the Development Process Manual, the Core API Manual, the Users and Administrators Guide, and, naturally, the Documentation Manual, among others. Moving documents into the appropriate books is an important task and needs to continue. There are a couple of challenges associated with this work. Though moving documentation files creates short-term pain for the people who work with those files, they are understandably unenthusiastic about such changes. There is also often resistance to organizing documentation for the convenience of its readers rather than that of its authors. Usually the case can be made to move a document once. We really don't want to keep shifting them around, though. Even when all documents are in the right place, though, we have only managed to turn a big pile into a group of smaller piles. The work of trying to knit all of those documents together into a single whole has not yet begun. If you have bright ideas on how we could proceed on that front, we would be more than happy to hear them.
Style sheet improvements.
With the adoption of Sphinx, we have much nicer looking HTML output than we once did. But it could still use a lot of improvement. Donald Knuth and Edward Tuft would be unimpressed. That requires tweaking our style sheets to create more typographically sound, accessible, and readable output. Be warned, if you take on this task, you are heading into classic Beicht territory. Expect a lot of opinions and discussion for even relatively obvious changes. That is, alas, the nature of the world we live in.
Non-LaTeX PDF build.
This is a decidedly non-trivial task for somebody with a lot of time and Python skills. The Sphinx toolchain is relatively small and well-contained. It is easy to add to a development system. But building PDF or EPUB output requires installing LaTeX, which is anything but small or well-contained. That would be a nice thing to eliminate. The original hope had been to use the RST2 PDF tool for PDF generation, but it turned out to not be up to the task. Development work on RST2 PDF seems to have picked up again in recent times, though, which is a hopeful sign. If a suitably motivated developer were to work with that project to make RST2 PDF work with the kernel documentation build, the world would be eternally grateful.
Write more documentation. Naturally, there are massive parts of the kernel that are severely underdocumented. If you have the knowledge to document a specific kernel subsystem and the desire to do so, please do not hesitate to do some writing and contribute the result to the kernel. Untold numbers of kernel developers and users will thank you. Postscript: for those who really want to see one of those talks, here is a video from Kernel Recipes 2019, YouTube. At the time of the election, anyone wanting to see the code had to sign an onerous NDA that said you could not release any of your findings for 5 years. She and her colleagues did not sign that agreement, so they could not see the code. 4 months after the election, so, mid-2019, it was changed to have a 45-day quiet period, which was far more reasonable. NSW is supposed to have laws mandating public access to source code, she said, but that does not apply to voting software. Part of what she wanted to convey in her talk is that laws about election software really matter. Switzerland has good laws of that sort, she said. New South Wales has very bad laws. She showed the laws for election software security, noting that they say nothing about actually securing that software. Instead, they impose penalties of up to 2 years in jail for disclosing the source code or flaws in the security of the voting software without approval. It is not just some part of a larger body of law requiring safe election practices. This is what substitutes for legislation mandating secure and transparent electoral processes. Unsurprisingly, the bug found in the Swiss post system was relevant to iVote, as they discovered later. The obvious correct fix for that bug was to simply add the relevant parameter into the hash, but Site took a completely different approach. They chose a random value, raised the missing parameter to that power, and hashed that instead, but that does not fix the problem. The parameter needs to be hashed so that it cannot be calculated later. Hashing it commits to a particular value. Raising it to a random power, without hashing, and thus committing to that random value, still allows the important parameter to be post-calculated. If the code had been available for analysis before the election, rather than 4 months after, the problem could have been spotted in short order. Instead, NSWEC ran the election with flawed, manipulable software because they did not make it openly available to scrutiny by people who knew what they were doing. She suggested that attendees look for themselves on the Site website that allows one to apply for access to the iVote code. She only spent a short amount of time verifying the problems they had already found, and discovering that the fix was no fix, but there is heaps and heaps of code there. Finding bugs in that code and getting them fixed will incrementally help secure the system before it gets used again.
Victoria,
she asked the audience how many were from NSW, many, and if they had used iVote, but seemingly no one had, or would admit to it. She then asked how many were from the state of Victoria, as she is. She asked, feeling smug, that was met with groans, noes, and scattered laughter as attendees guessed that things there were probably not much better, or perhaps even worse. At the end of 2019, a law passed the lower chamber of the legislative body for Victoria that would allow the Minister for Elections to choose a voting system that would be universally applied to all local elections, i.e., not for federal offices. It allows the minister to choose postal voting, which has a body of laws already to govern election security and privacy, attendance voting, which has an even older set of laws surrounding it, or anything else he feels like with no restrictions whatsoever. It is clear what the agenda is, Teague said. There is no groundswell for voting with bronze discs or pottery shards. It is meant to facilitate large-scale, totally unregulated electronic voting compulsorily for everyone who is voting in local elections in Victoria. The legislation is coming up for a vote in the upper body in February. She suggested that attendees from Victoria figure out who their 5 representatives are and contact them to request the removal of that clause. Once we lose the ability to have genuine democratic local elections in Victoria, we are never getting it back.
Risk-limiting audits.
She then shifted gears to talk about a pilot project that she participated in to do a risk-limiting audit for a San Francisco district attorney election. Instead of talking about electronic voting, the second half of her keynote would be about electronic counting of paper votes, which is an easier problem in every way, Teague said. Assuming that the paper records have been properly secured along the way, there exists a full record of voters' intents that can be double-checked against the tallies provided by counting devices. In jurisdictions that use paper ballots in the U.S., that kind of double-checking is often done, Serious statistical audits of those paper records are performed to ensure that the electronic counting system is accurate. There are a number of sophisticated statistical analysis techniques that can be used to give a level of confidence that the outcome has not been subject to malware or bugs in the counting systems. In her opinion, the best technique is risk-limiting audits. At the beginning of an election, the auditors will need to decide on the probability of being tricked they are willing to live with. If you are doing random sampling, there is always some possibility that the statistics do not reflect the results. Then there are calculations that can be made to determine how to do the sampling such that those constraints are met. If the sampling indicates that the reported outcome is not as it should be, then a full count by hand should be done. These audits are used in several states, but the U.S. has a really weird primitive voting system where a single candidate is chosen by each voter and the one with the most votes wins. The audit is just checking to ensure that the declared winner is actually the candidate with the most votes. But some U.S. jurisdictions are starting to use instant runoff voting, which in Australia is called voting, she said to Laughter. It is a great voting system, she said, but it breaks the risk-limiting audit frameworks that are in place. She got involved in a project to take the Australian understanding of preference voting and to combine it with the ideas of risk-limiting audits for the most recent election in San Francisco, which was held in November 2019. LWN covered a talk about other aspects of San Francisco election handling back in August. The district attorney election had four candidates and the results were quite close. She and her colleagues in the project decided to test their risk-limiting audit techniques on that race. They only got access to the postal votes, which turned out to be about two-thirds of the votes cast. So the audit did not actually provide evidence that the outcome of the election was correctly decided, but it demonstrated how the audit could work in an election with preferential voting. It turns out that the outcome when considering just the postal votes is the opposite of the outcome when looking at all of the votes, because polling place voters overwhelmingly chose the winning candidate. That doesn't really affect the math, nor does it affect how this thing, in its ideal form, should work. The idea behind the project is to provide a set of completely open, publicly available verification and auditing tools. The actual counting machines are a kind of scanner and digitizer that comes from a proprietary company, Dominion, that she does not trust any more than she does cite there is no opportunity to look at the code, but they did get the report from that system, which detailed the choices counted on each ballot. The seventh ballot in bag 52 has this list of preferences. Using that list, a random selection of ballots is chosen to be audited. Those will be examined and compared with what the counting system reported. A tally of discrepancies is then maintained. Then there are two different sets of math analysis that need to be done. The first is to carefully determine which parts of the preferences are important in terms of the outcome. The order in which the losing candidates are eliminated can sometimes make a big difference in the overall outcome, because the next level of voter preference is then boosted from ballots that preferred the eliminated candidate. Switching the order can cascade into a completely different winner, though usually that is not the case. Normally, the low vote getters can be eliminated in any order and it does not affect the outcome. The tool that they developed looked at the election and determined which of the comparisons were critical and then ignored the rest, for auditing purposes. The second piece is to do the careful statistics for eliminating the possibility that the comparison was made wrongly. Both pieces are available as open source software. Risk-limiting audits for instant runoff vote elections, rare, and sets of half-average nulls generate risk-limiting audits, Shangri-La. Citizens in San Francisco were able to observe the auditing process, see which ballots were chosen to be sampled, compare them to the reported preferences, and then run the calculations themselves if they wished. The code can be used by others to reproduce the results or to add different types of statistical measures, for example. Back to Oz. So, like the mechanisms to verify every step of an e-voting election, an electronically counted election can also be verified using an open process, even though the software running on the devices may not be available for scrutiny. But, she asked, what does this have to do with the Australian Senate count? You probably have already guessed, not a lot. She went over some testimony by the Electoral Commissioner about the integrity of the Senate count. Pointed questions were asked about whether any manual auditing of the ballots had been done and whether the error rate for data entry had been estimated, but the commissioner said that he would need to look into both of those questions. But when asked about whether the commission had followed the recommendations of the last inquiry by the Australian Parliament about the Senate elections, which were to appoint expert scrutineers to observe the ballot counting process, his memory suddenly returned. Parliament had only recommended that action, not required it by law. There is an important element to his answer, Teague said. Actual legislation is needed to ensure that voting is secure. The Swiss e-voting laws are detailed and well thought out, with an orientation toward transparency of the process, privacy for the voters,
and the ability to verify the results. They are not perfect, but they are quite good. Switzerland found out about its problems as soon as it forced the source code to be open, she said to applause. In contrast, New South Wales found out about its problems 12 days before the election. California has pretty decent laws about election auditing, but the Australian Senate scrutineering rules have not been updated since the days of hand-counted paper ballots, which was a long time ago. In effect, those rules say that scrutineers must be allowed to stand in the room while they do their thing on their computers. It does not say anything about providing meaningful evidence that those computers are doing the right thing. What she believes is needed for the Senate count is a mandate for a statistical audit of the paper ballots that can be meaningfully observed by scrutineers. There is no need for the perfect law, just for something that requires auditing and allows public oversight. It seems rather obvious that the Electoral Commission is not going to do so unless they are forced, so a legislative mandate for that is needed, she said. The Senate count is a place where there is a risk for undetectable electoral fraud, she said, particularly in the last few seats where lots and lots of preference shifting has been needed to decide them. It would be pretty difficult to fiddle with the tallies for the top vote-getters from the major parties, she said, but the preferences further down the list could be more easily manipulated. Unlike some e-voting systems, such as iVote, the Senate count is in a much better position to be audited because the paper records exist.
A new project?
She finished on a slightly upbeat note. Rather than spending 2020 by picking holes in bad software, she thought it might be better to work on a new project. Democracy is about more than just elections she spent some time working to defeat, or even just amend, the shocking train wreck that was our anti-encryption laws that were passed at the end of 2018. Working to try to convince legislators is not something she ever wants to be involved in again, but it did get her thinking. The legislative process in Australia is fairly open. The text of the proposed bills is available online under a Creative Commons license. What if there were an online amendment and voting site that would allow cryptographically verified voting on the bills, amendments, and the like? It would allow people to more actively participate in the process and to provide input in ways other than writing 50,000 submissions to various committees that ignore what we write. She thinks a version could also be rolled out for teenagers so that they could practice debating various issues of the day. The e-voting verification techniques could be used to give users some level of assurance that the votes are being tallied correctly, while familiarizing people with the approach. The lack of an Australian digital ID will make it difficult to trust the aggregation, since the identities of the participants cannot be verified, however. In any case, she would like to pursue something down this path and solicited attendees to tell her that it is a bad idea or to give suggestions for better ones. I would like to thank LWN's travel sponsor, the Linux Foundation, for travel assistance to Gold Coast for linux.conferencia.eu.